Hi, I'm Rob Afuso. You're listening to Sydney Taylor at Metal from the Inside.
You've tuned in to the most crazy rocking metal podcast on the air. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Metal from the Inside.
Hey guys, how is everybody doing? I'm your host, Sydney Taylor, and you are listening to the Metal from the Inside podcast. Thank you guys so much for tuning into another episode and joining me for another week. You are listening to episode 40 of the Metal from the Inside podcast, and this week I am bringing you guys a brand new interview with Rob Afuso, original drummer for the band Skid Row. Rob played on some of the band's most iconic records, including 1989's self-titled debut, as well as Slave to the Grind, Beside Ourselves, Subhuman Race, and all of those really great early Skid Row records. What's really funny about having Rob on the podcast is that he's actually from where I grew up, and I know that the region, the Hudson Valley, kind of just bounces around on the podcast, and of course, it's the title of the weekly show that I do over on Sea of Tranquility, the Hudson Valley Squares, but that is where I grew up, the Hudson Valley in New York, and that is where Rob grew up as well. And it's really funny because growing up, my mom knew a lot of people who were friends with Rob and Rob's brother and family. And so Rob Afuso has just always been a name that I knew growing up. And especially when I got into hard rock and metal, I, of course, discovered the greatness of Skid Row. I mentioned this a little bit in the conversation, but that self-titled debut record was so important to me when I was really getting into this music when I was younger. And I actually had seen Sebastian Bach solo, because at that point, keep in mind, I am only 21 at the moment. So when I was younger, Skid Row had already broken up, you know, the Skid Row that played on those original records. And so there was the other Skid Row, which is the Skid Row that we have now, of course, with a different vocalist at that time. And then there was also Sebastian Bach, who is still doing his own solo thing and has put out some really killer records. But I had seen Sebastian when I was 7 years old, and when he played with Dokken and Poison, which is just like a match made in heaven for me. But I got to see him when I was 7, and 18 in Life, when I was that age, was my favorite song. I always joke around and tell the story. You know, when I was younger, I didn't really have access to a lot of CDs or music or anything. I mean, that I could physically know how to put on myself. There were CDs and physical copies all over the house. But when I was 6 or 7, I needed help putting stuff on or whatever. But I would beg my brother to put on 18 in Life, and he used to bribe me to do his chores for him so he would put on that song for me. So that album and Skid Row goes way, way back, and they're one of my favorite bands from that time period. So I was so happy to sit down and speak with Rob. And it's funny, as I've gotten into the industry, I've started to do some other work for some really great companies, and one of them is Experience Vinyl. And Rob has some really great ties to Experience Vinyl and great people who work there that are some of my friends now. And it just all came to be to have Rob on the podcast. So I'm very excited to be sharing this interview with Rob on episode 40, this episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast. But before I get into what exactly we talked about in the interview that you're about to hear, I really wanted to thank you guys so much for the incredible response that I received on last week's episode, episode 39, my conversation with my hero, Alice Cooper. The reception that I received is just beyond overwhelming. And aside from what I'm going to get into of some really great and big publications and radio stations picking the interview up, I was just blown away by just people saying congratulations to me because they knew how big of a deal that was for me. So I really want to thank everybody who showed any type of support for that interview, and especially for all of you that sat down and took the time to listen to it. And what's really great is on Monday, I saw that Ultimate Classic Rock and Loudwire actually picked up a tidbit from the interview. Alice revealed what he promises his band members when they join the band, the three things he promises: that they're gonna see the world, they're gonna get paid, and they're gonna get stitches. And those three things just shook the rock world, I guess. It appeared on Ultimate Classic Rock, Loudwire, my local hard rock radio station, which all of my Philly people know very well, 93.3 WMMR. It even reached Kiss FM, which is Ryan Seacrest's radio station in LA. It reached iHeartRadio. It hit TMZ even. I was just, I'm still blown away. I'm still seeing people covering it in articles and Facebook posts and Twitter posts. And it was just unbelievable, you know, to have that opportunity to sit down and speak with Alice, not only for nothing related to wanting to get publicity or coverage for it, just because Alice means so much to me. And then to have that happen and to have it kind of blow up like that, it was absolutely incredible. So it would not be right if I did not thank you guys so much for the support and for sharing it, listening to it. Again, if you would like to actually see Alice and I's chat and Rob and I's chat as well, you can subscribe to the Metal from the Inside YouTube channel. Again, just go to YouTube, type in the search bar Metal from the Inside, and we will be the first hit. Here you can actually watch Alice and I's conversation, our Zoom call, all that fun stuff if you would like to actually have a visual representation of our conversation and not just audio. We just passed 1,200 subscribers on the YouTube channel, which is so amazing. And I just thank you guys so, so much. Again, if you haven't listened to episode 39, my conversation with Alice Cooper, I definitely recommend that you go back and listen to it because it was so much fun. And I just think will forever remain my favorite episode of the podcast that I've done. So go ahead and check that out. But again, we are back this week with a brand new interview with original Skid Row drummer Rob Afuso. And in this interview, we cover a lot of ground, everything from what Rob is doing currently and even going back and reliving some of the old Skid Row days, including his memories recording that self-titled debut record, Slave to the Grind, and what it felt like for him to achieve the dream that he had always had when he was younger of literally becoming a rock star and getting to tour the world, play incredible shows like the Moscow Peace Festival, and just all of that incredible stuff that Skid Row got to do at that time and that Rob was a part of. So we get into that. And like I mentioned, we talk about what Rob has been up to lately, including the 4x Fate project that he was a part of a couple years back. You will have to listen to the interview to find out if there is anything on the horizon for 4x Fate. But of course, 4x Fate includes some of the members of the original Freelease Comet, and it had included the late AJ Pirro, who of course played for Twisted Sister and unfortunately passed away. So Rob had come in and taken his place for that record that I think was released back in 2016. It was either 2015 or 2016. So we talk a little bit about what's on the horizon for 4x Fate, what's going on with that project and that band. We also talk about Rob becoming a college professor as he is gearing up to teach his very first college course at Mount St. Mary regarding music business, which is something that is really close to my heart. I just graduated with a music business degree, which I have talked about on the podcast before, but when I found out that Rob was going to be teaching a course in music business, it just made me so happy to know that there is even more education becoming available in this field for people like me who just want to learn more and more about this part of the industry, and especially from someone as seasoned as Rob and has watched the industry change over the years. So we talk about how Rob got that opportunity and what the progress is on getting that course moving. We also chat about Rob's current musical endeavors, including his drum lessons. If you are a drummer and are looking to set up some lessons with Rob, you can go to Rob's official website, robafuso.com. Go ahead and email the email that is provided and Rob will get back to you with all of the necessary information. So keep that in mind if you are a drummer that is looking to expand their knowledge on the instrument. We also talk about Rob's current band, Soul System Orchestras, which he founded way back when, many years back, and it's a fantastic kind of more big band vibe. They play Motown classics, a lot of music in that realm, and they play a lot of different events. Rob is hoping that they make a full return once live music, of course, returns. So we talk about the origins of Soul System and what they're up to currently, and also just Rob's overall background, how he got into drums, what his passions and goals were pre-Skid Row, and just his history in general. So it was really great getting to sit down and speak with Rob. Again, I've had communications with him over the last year and have always had his name floating around my house and, of course, in my mind as a hard rock and metal fan. So I was so happy to have him join me on episode 40 of the Metal from the Inside podcast. As always, stick around at the end of the episode to hear one last message from me. But without further ado, when we get back from this very short break, we're going to get right into my interview with original Skid Row drummer Rob Afuso. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on this week's episode. I know we kind of, it was a little bit in setting this up. Both of our schedules are a little crazy, but we finally made it work.
Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, absolutely. Skid Row is one of those bands, and I want to get into other stuff that you do too, sure. Of course, because you're more than just Skid Row. But, you know, Skid Row is one of those bands that for me, when I was really getting into this type of music, was so important to me. And, I would listen to, you know, this 18 in Life, you know, over and over and over again when I was younger, because it was just one of those songs that I loved. It really got me into this, you know, genre of music and just for me personally. So you're doing a lot, you know, right now. Like I said, you know, you're still, I feel like a lot of times people only kind of look at you for, you know, working with Skid Row, which of course is a huge part of your career. But right now you're teaching lessons. You're even teaching a course at Mount St. Mary College, which, you know, I just graduated with a degree in music business. So to, you know, see that you were teaching that was pretty cool. So if you want to talk a little bit just about, you know, what you've been up to and, you know, teaching that course and just all that kind of fun stuff you've been up to as of late.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously Skid Row, gave me a platform to do all these other things. I mean, of course I could give lessons and teach at school, but obviously that makes it a whole lot easier for people to want you. Yes, Skid Row was a huge part of my life and probably a third of my life, actually. And I guess early on in Skid Row, it was about 1992, I think. It was just around Slave to the Grind time. I just decided we were out on the road and just playing hard rock, heavy metal all the time. And every night I'd come back to the bus and I'd lay down in the bunk and I'd put on Motown music or soul, old soul. And I was like, wow, I'd love, you know, the horn section. I love the multiple singers up front doing the... So I started a band because I just love that music. It was 1993 I started, called Soul System. I know Paul Stanley's now doing something similar. I've had this passion for this music for a long time. So I started this band back then, and we'd be out on the road doing Slave to the Grind with Pantera, and then I'd come home and I'd play Motown with Soul System. And it was just a really nice balance of life, you know. I just said to people, you know, it's who wants to eat steak every night of the week, you know, of your life. So it was a nice balance. So Soul System sort of morphed into a company with its success. It was just a really great band, and so now the company does high-end events around the world. Events meaning private events, you know, say for like American Express, for instance, or large banks, insurance companies, and celebrity high-end weddings, things of that nature. So we do that, with COVID, there was no playing. There was no playing live, and so I went back into educating and teaching, and I really found myself enjoying that again. I haven't really, with Skid Row, I didn't read music. There's no need to read music. It was all from the soul. So it was really nice to get back into reading music, which I did a good part of my life. So it's sort of, in teaching, I also retaught myself how to read. And it's been really fun having this teaching experience. And then, I'm just giving you a little vignettes here, yeah, through, you know, what I've been up to. And then also, this was actually pre-COVID. I had gotten a call from a local university, Mount St. Mary College, and just asked if I'd be interested in being on the business school advisory board. And I'm like, sure, I'll advise your business, whatever. So, in that, I had this, all of a sudden, I had this passion to create a class that I saw that they had a business school, but no music and nothing in music or entertainment production. I said, well, what a great idea. So I created this class and presented it to them, and they absolutely loved it and asked me to, you know, come on as adjunct professor. So that happened pre-COVID, and then they said, okay, you can do this, but it's got to be online. And I'm like, Jesus, I've never taught a class to a college level, so I'm not going to do this online. So, in fact, I haven't started teaching the class. We're hoping that this classes go back in September. And basically, it's all kinds of the idea. It's all an intro to all these different vignettes of music business opportunities, whether it be, you know, booking talent, production, management, recording studio management, things of those things. The course outlines what you need to do. I give, it's going to give people the opportunity to meet people in that industry. Of course, right now, it can't be done because the industry doesn't exist, unfortunately. It's sad, but hopefully soon we'll be back. And then 4x Fate. Oh, we forgot about 4x Fate in there. That 4x Fate, yes, that was 4x Fate. A lot of fun band. I was unfortunately, they were recording their album, and AJ Perro from Twisted Sister was the drummer, and unfortunately he passed away while they were in the middle of that album. The guys in 4x Fate was started by John Regan and Todd Howarth, who were the original members of Free These Comet. And John went on to play with Peter Frampton for 30 years. And then also Pat Gasparini, great songwriter, did a lot of the songwriting for us for 4x Fate. So we did that, I think it was about 2016 that came together. And we toured Australia and did some dates with 4x Fate. We released an album called Relentless. Great group of guys. We had a lot of fun doing that. You know, the commercial success wasn't there, but we had fun, and it was a great opportunity to play new music and tour again. So.
Yeah. Do you guys have anything, you know, possibly on the horizon for that? Because, I mean, I know you guys, of course, released that first record. Did you guys ever toy around with the idea of doing another one?
Well, we toy around, meaning like, on social media or on a text, you know, say, hey, you shitheads, I miss you fuckers. Let's get the band back together. You know, so I don't know. There's been loose conversation. I would love to. I think it'd be fun to do another album with those guys. It was a fun experience. I'd like to do it again. So I'll call them after we're done. Actually, here, Todd.
Call him right now. I want another 4x Fate album. Yeah, come on.
he won't answer. He's too busy. Todd's in San Diego. He's too busy fixing his cars or something.
Yeah, but I mean, that was a fun project that, you know, yeah, like you said, he released that record. And I remember when it came out and kind of you guys played the chance and did a couple, you know, shows and everything, which is really cool. What else have you been doing, you know, music-wise? Do you still write stuff for yourself, really? Or do you kind of primarily right now kind of focus on the lessons you do and that kind of stuff?
So, you know, unfortunately for me, I'm not really a songwriter. I have songwriting credits. I did write some basic parts in Skid Row, but for me to sit down and write a song from beginning to end, you know, generally what would happen is I'd hear things in my head. I couldn't play piano or guitar. I could play guitar, but not enough to give an idea of what I was hearing. So what I would do is I would come up with these ideas, and I'd tell Snake or Scotty or Rachel, you know, play this, and then we would work around that. Same thing with Todd and John and Pat in 4x Fate, same kind of a thing. So no, unfortunately, I don't write music very well, and so, you know, which is why I choose other avenues to keep playing music and being musical, and keeping busy and keeping it, you know, doing it as a living.
Yeah, like, has it been rewarding for you to teach lessons and things like that? Because, you know, I feel like right now, especially in this kind of climate where music is in a weird place and the industry is in a weird place and all this stuff and you know, especially not only just that, but, you know, I'm also paying very much attention to kind of over the last couple of years, you know, rock has kind of gone a little bit into the underground, not too much in the mainstream. So for you to be able to, you know, teach drummers that are learning or, you know, that are up and coming, is it something that you kind of feel is really rewarding for you?
Yes. Teaching is rewarding, especially, you know, when you're trying to teach a concept or something and the student isn't quite getting it, and you talk them through it and they get it and they play it, and then they feel this confidence, and I can see this confidence in them that, wow, I got this. And that's really exciting to me, and to be able to see one's progression as I give them lessons. And, you know, I have a couple students like that now who I see their progress weekly, and it's very rewarding.
Yeah. And where can people contact you for doing lessons? On your website, right? Primarily?
They can contact me through the website, robafuso.com. And then there's a info at robafuso.com. That's actually managed, that email. I see it. It's sent to me, but I'm not, like, it's not me.
But you just launched that new website, I know, not too long ago. It's really nice. It's got everything. It's got everything about you. And again, like your contact and everything like that. And you're even starting, I know you started this new kind of collections thing that you've been working on. So if you want to talk a little bit about that, because I knew that that's kind of new and in the works for you.
Yeah. Well, a few years back, I was asked to do that business school advisory board. And the initial meeting for that was a board panel. And I met Brandon Steiner on there. Brandon Steiner was the owner of Steiner Sports, based in New York, and the biggest sports collectible company in the world, one of the top. He ended up selling the company, got out of that, started another company, and had approached me about doing music collectibles. Instead of sports figures, do music. And said, well, let's create something for you, and then you will take that and you're going to run with the music side of this collectibles company. So what we do is we create unique pieces. It's not necessarily like selling old T-shirts. We may. But those are one of the kind auction type items.
Yeah.
But you know, we create. For instance, I got the cowbell. I got the cowbell that we recorded Monkey Business on. So that cowbell that I played, I got that model, and I signed 250 of those, and we're creating kind of a box with the figure from Monkey Business and the signed cowbell, and so stuff like that. And so that's what we do for me, and I would do that. I'm going to help other artists, other bands, create those things for themselves, and it goes up on their website. It's just when someone like yourself wants to buy something, you go in to their website, you click buy, and it sends it to my shop.
Gotcha.
Their shop, but this company that are creating this, we create it with the artist, and then
gotcha.
they sign everything. It's all it's all up and up. It's all legal, documented, so you know you're getting the real thing. So that was another thing that we did during COVID, just trying to keep busy in music and keeping the marketing wheels spinning. Before Skid Row, I went to NYU for marketing and PR. Sort of didn't really use that much during the Skid Row days because we had other people doing it, but, I always had that sense. And so as Skid Row started to wane at the end there, I was like, uh-oh, I better put this shit to use. So I fall back on all those, on that those lessons I've learned at NYU and marketing and ideas, and still applying that to everything I do.
Yeah, I think that's so important, and especially in the music business. I mean, a lot of people, I feel like, and not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but a lot of people don't really have that, under their belt, so that's it's such an important skill to have, and being able to market your career and press and all that stuff. So that's an important skill to have for sure.
It is. Well, I did fight my dad tooth and nail about going to college. And somehow he won and made me pay for it. I'm not sure how did that happen? I guess I wasn't a good negotiator.
Yeah, but I mean, you're going to be teaching this music business class, and it's something that is really important. Like I went, like I said, I went to school for music business, and a lot of the people that I went to school with, I was somebody, I went because I wanted to literally know about the music business. I'm not a performer, I'm not an artist, but a lot of people I went to college with were performers who are trying to learn these skills for themselves, so that when they get into a situation with having a manager or having a PR publicity firm or something, like they have some kind of idea about what work these people are doing for them, and I think that it's definitely, even now, you know, I'm sure at this point in your career, like you said, it's come to be a helpful skill.
Nothing can replace knowledge and information, you know, yeah. So it's really up to you to know and not be taken advantage of in the business as an artist. When I decided to go to NYU, I initially wanted to go to Syracuse because I was a huge basketball fan, and I was a big Syracuse basketball fan. And I did play basketball in high school, but I was not nearly good enough to play at a college level. So I wanted to go to Syracuse so I could play drums in the pep band, you know, so I could travel right with the team. But I went up there and I saw the snow drifts were higher than the trucks that were plowing the snow. So I decided not to go to Syracuse. I went to NYU because I figured, well, if I want to be a drummer, if I want to get into the business as a drummer, as a musician, I should be in New York City, and you know, at this point, and learn the business of this, all the while trying to forward my career as a musician. So I really wanted to be a musician. I probably wouldn't have been happy being on the business side early on. So I'm really glad that it worked out.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about kind of how that transition happened for you when you were going to school and then you got into Skid Row. Because, I mean, I've heard a little bit about this, Justin, and being a music fan and being a fan of this genre and the band, but I haven't really heard it from you. And so I'm curious as to how that kind of happened.
Well, it's quite a long story because there's many players and it was over some time. So I'll do my best to give you a edited version of it. It started, I had a girlfriend who became my wife, who became my ex-wife, who introduced me to David Bryan, keyboard player from Bon Jovi. There was that angle. And then there was another friend a mutual friend I had that knew Snake. So this was just random life stuff. And so I was playing in a band in South Jersey called the Sutton Thomas Band. Very different. It was more of a kind of progressive pop band along the lines of maybe Tears for Fears, that kind of a vibe. And Bon Jovi was breaking with Runaway on WAPP back then. And I heard that he was going to be auditioning drummers. So I tried to get an audition for this. Now, it took about a year it was mostly David Bryan that helped with that. And so I had been learning, you know, I wasn't really a rock and roll drummer at this point. I was really more of a progressive rock kind of guy, more pop. And I was at the beach and I got a call, hey Rob, can you be at the studio in 2 hours? Well, the studio is an hour from where I was in North Jersey. And I was at the beach and my drum set was in the studio. I said, sure, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
So I run home. I had a Toyota Corolla and a 15-piece drum set. So I took the necessary items I could fit into the car. I ran home. You know, I had my shorts on. I think I went to the audition flip-flops. I forgot to put my shoes on. I was so excited. So I got there right on time, set up, and played. I auditioned for Bon Jovi with Richie and Alec and John and obviously not Tico, but and David, and Snake happened to be there. Snake was good friends with John. So after the audition, he came up and he said, hey, I don't really know how this is going to work out with John, but if things don't work out, I'm putting this band together with a buddy down at Tom's River Music Store. And, you know, maybe if it doesn't work out, let's connect. So I said, sure. So eventually it didn't work out. Snake and I connected, got the audition, and that's how I got into Skid Row.
Yeah. I mean, like that just started that was a whole journey. And I mean, because you obviously, of course, got into the band prior to Sebastian joining. So that you guys were kind of the initial kind of group, and then Sebastian joined later.
It was Snake, Rachel, and I. And then Scotty. Now I think Matt Fallon was the original singer. He was sort of in and out at the time, but then Scotty came along. I remember Matt was still in the band, and then we would have rehearsals and shows, and Matt wouldn't show up, so we had to let Matt go. And it took us about 2 years to find Sebastian, who came through Mark Weiss. I know you had Mark Weiss on the show.
Yeah.
I saw your picture you posted. So Mark had Sebastian, Mark saw Sebastian sing at a wedding. It might have been his, no, it wasn't his wedding, but it was up in Canada. And he said, man, you got to check this guy out. So after a year and a half or so of looking for a singer, we found Sebastian, and he came down, and that was it.
Yeah. And you just mentioned, talking with Mark Weiss, and I love the one picture, because I'm sure obviously you've seen his book and everything like that. You know, he has one picture in there of you guys, and you guys were so glammed out. And it's the one picture. You guys were so glammed out, and I saw that picture.
Like young girls.
was that? I'm curious, because was that like the band's direction, or was that like at that time were you guys just trying to find out if you guys were going to be that type of like image band or anything like that, or was that something that Mark was like, try this?
No, we were going. That's a good question. We were going really, for the glam metal type thing. And I don't remember, but you'll see that's about the only picture you're going to see of us that glam. Thank God for me. And you know what? Rachel was totally, totally into that. He was a punk glam dude, and that served him really well. That was really for that moment in that picture. That was something, trying to be something that I wasn't.
Right.
I'm sort of glad that didn't stick. But there was still a glam side to the band. It was just a little edgier and dirtier.
Yeah.
And that's sort of, we fell into this is who we are. And that made a lot more sense.
Right. Yeah. It's so funny that one picture. Yeah. I've never seen, like you said, it's like the only picture like that. And yeah, it's, I've never seen anything like that before. Cause you still have like, Sebastian
you
was in.
Do you have it there? You can pull it up.
I don't have it right here right now. But I'll insert it when I do the editing. I'll put it up here so that everybody can see it. But it's one of those things. I mean, like, cause Sebastian, I know, kind of came from Madam X, I believe he was in, and he had the huge hair, and that kind of ended.
He was totally into the glam scene as well. Yeah.
Right.
Michael Monroe was one of his idols. Yeah.
Yeah, so that, if you guys haven't seen that picture, I'm going to put it up right now. So you can try not to embarrass Rob. That's going to be right here.
A lot of people love that picture, because that was before. I mean, that was early Skid Row.
Yeah, it's about the earliest of all five of you together.
That was before anybody ever heard the album,
which is incredible. And I mean, for you, it must be, even hearing kind of like, me talk about it, and I know you get this a lot, because people, talk about Skid Row and just the importance of that band in their lives and everything. I mean, for you, is it crazy to kind of reflect back on this journey and, that first album, and even Slave to the Grind, which was even bigger than that first album, just the legacy that those two records especially have had, because, it's over 30 years later, new fans are getting into those albums every day. It's one of those things where it still gets played on the radio. It's still recognized, heavily by music fans. So is it something for you that's kind of surreal and that you kind of never imagined would happen?
Well, you give me the chills just saying those things, to be honest with you. No, you never realize, you never expect that. I mean, I just the other day, I was sort of reminiscing about the early days before we even got our record deal. But just knowing all that, there was all this anticipation and all this movement around the band and excitement, and me thinking to myself, I'm getting chills again, thinking, wow, my dream might come true. I want to be a rock star. This is happening. And it was pretty special. And, to then actually realize that dream and then have the music you've created be pieces of music that have stood the test of time for 30 years, and people are still asking you to sign their albums and sending you things. And even though I'm no longer in the band, and that current lineup doesn't exist anymore, it was still a huge piece of rock and roll history. And I'm really honored to be a part of it.
Yeah. It's, one of those things where that's, even for my life and, my parents' life and, my mom's life, and it's a big, part of the soundtrack to somebody's life. Yeah, I will tell her hello, because it's without my parents, I always say this, a lot of my listeners know this, I was heavily influenced by my parents with my music taste, and you know, I grew up listening to that first album and to Youth Gone Wild. And, you know, that's like when I was very young, that's what I was listening to. And so, you know, it really has stood the test of time. And, you know, I'm not the only one. There's peers that I have that love the band and that, especially that lineup of the band, you know, just as much as I do. And so, you know, I think, yeah, it must be incredible for you. Cause I mean, I know that you also, you know, occasionally back in 2019, you did, I saw Sebastian back in 2016 and at the Chance, and you came up and played a couple songs, and you know, you still have the opportunity to play those songs occasionally when Sebastian and you are in the same place. So for you, it must also kind of be, you know, fun to get up there and play those old songs with him.
Of course it is. It's also nerve wracking, to be honest, you know, because they're up there doing it every night and I have to remember these songs that I recorded 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but it's great. And it's always great to see him. It's always great to see the other guys. I don't, you know, we're now all over the country, different places. I'm on the East Coast. Sebastian's on the West Coast. Rachel's in the middle of the country in Nashville. Snake goes back and forth from there to New York. Scotty's in LA. So, you know, I don't really see those guys very much. Sebastian does reach out when he comes through the New York area or anywhere in the Northeast and see if I want to come by, which is really cool. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Does he give you a little bit of a warning so you have some time to like have a refresher, or does he just give you a call that morning? You
know, like at 4 p.m. of the day of the show, dude, where are you, man? I'm going to be at the Chance tonight. Why don't you come up and play a couple tunes?
Is it really that late?
Sometimes, yes.
Oh my goodness.
Well, yes. And then there's, you know, there's the time my most recent time was just before COVID. I played with him at the Sony Theater in New York City. Were you there?
I was not there because I was waiting for him to come here. And then COVID happened. And so I never got to see that show because he was supposed to play here in the May or the June or something. And then, you know, we know how that happened.
We had discussed that I was going to come out on a couple of shows with him. And then, right. And so then those all, and they were all going to be a surprise, but we'll see. Hopefully next year we'll do a few of those.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's at this point, I mean, he's rescheduled that tour again. And I think now he's rescheduling it again. And it's like, oh, I just want it. And now it's like the 32nd anniversary of the album because it's supposed to be the 30th.
It was the 30th. Right? He started it as the 30th anniversary. Well, you know what? And such is life. Here we are. But fortunately, we're all good and healthy and made it through.
That's the beauty of it, right? You know, it's the most important thing. You know, I want live music back as much as anybody. But, you know, it's important too, you know, trying to do it in a safe way and make sure everybody's safe while doing it and not rush into doing it. You know, all of us want it back, you know, but it's going to take a little bit of time. But I mean, with those two albums, you know, like I said, you know, the first album, Enslaved to the Grind, you know, is there any, like either one really more memorable for you than the other one? I mean, I know that they're both kind of very important albums for you in your career, but when you look back on making both of those and recording them and just that time, you know, which one kind of really stands out to you?
Well, you know, each one has a very memorable aspect of it. The first one was just that, the first one that we had never done an album before. And again, like I said, all the excitement and the hype that was around this new band, Skid Row, who was going to be, you know, Atlantic Records answer to Guns N' Roses. I don't think we got quite that far, but you know, we certainly did well. And we're Atlantic Records, Guns N' Roses, basically at that time. But you know, being in the studio, I remember just the anticipation, and I remember Michael Wagner towards the end of the album, the recording process, saying, he says, "Guys, this is a really strong album." He said, "I could easily see this going platinum, maybe several times platinum," and we were all like, "Are you kidding? You know, shut up!" And because you don't really think that's possible. Only other people can do that. But so that anticipation and that excitement as really young, you know, rookie rock stars made it really special, the innocence that we had. And then Slave to the Grind was a much more aggressive, heavy metal album than the first one. And we also wanted to do that and keep a real sense of ourselves and not go too far away from, you know, the sing-along chorus, the power, you know, the powers of the sing-along chorus, but still keep it heavy and rock and roll. And going into that, I have to say it was very nerve-wracking because we had such success of the first album. And going in and recording Slave to the Grind, which we did in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which did not make things easy to concentrate. we're very good when it's time to perform and record. We're very straight. We're always very straight and, you know, focused. But afterwards, we partied pretty hard all the time. So, you know, going in and trying to focus and make this great album that was going to be a follow-up to the first one is a lot of pressure. You know, you have your whole life to write this first album, and you have a year to write the second album. I don't know if you've heard that before,
yeah.
but it's very true. So there's two very different experiences, and I remember being on the bus when that album was released. We were just going out on tour, and management came in and said, "Congratulations, guys, Slave to the Grind debuted at number one on Billboard charts," and I have that right there on my wall. Maybe I'll take you for a little tour here. So there's very different experiences there, but both were very important. And you know what? Honestly, even the Besides Ourselves album, I don't know, I loved that. That was so much fun. You know, we did that on tour. On our days off, we'd find a, you know, we'd have a studio picked out. We'd pick a song that each one of us loved, or from a band each one of us loved, and we went and recorded it. And that was so much fun, and there was no pressure because it was just fun. And you know, that memory, every one of those songs, I remember the studio and there was, like I said, there was no pressure, and we put a lot of pressure on ourselves in the studio to be great. And then the final Subhuman Race album, frankly, is one of my favorite albums to perform because Bob Rock sort of took the chains off of me and let me really go and experiment as a drummer and be a little bit more of the drummer that I was used to being before Skid Row. Michael Wagner really made me focus, eliminate a lot of drum fills, keep it simple, stupid, and obviously it works. But Subhuman Race, we made it a little bit different. I loved it. I love that album. I loved recording it. I think the guys didn't love it as much, but and that was also kind of a weird time. The record company was making changes. The industry, you know, Nirvana came out, Pearl Jam came out. The industry was changing. We started infighting, and sadly, that sort of was the start of the demise of Skid Row.
Now, I know you kind of talked about before you got into Skid Row, you were kind of more of a Tears for Fears, you were in that kind of field. Now, when you were kind of looking at your future and your goals of becoming, you know, a professional musician, were you originally kind of looking for a hard rock, you know, type band, or was that something that you were kind of willing to take any opportunity and kind of run with it?
Well, exactly. I was willing to take it. And I said Tears for Fears off the top of my head because I just remember they did a lot of sequencing stuff, and I mean, I was more of a progressive rock drummer. I liked Genesis. I liked, but I also loved AC/DC, and I loved Emerson, Lake and Palmer, but I also loved Led Zeppelin. So, you know, I was sort of all over the map on there, but not really, you know, at that time I wasn't a Metallica guy. I wasn't into that hard thrash metal at that time. So yes, I wanted to be in a band that was big and powerful. I didn't know what that meant. Strong, big, strong, aggressive sound, and I think I got that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, like you said, even with you know, Slave to the Grind, you know, that was something. I mean, you guys went from, you know, kind of touring with other bands, and when that first record came out, and then you guys ended up touring, you know, with Pantera, which was, you know, they kind of grew up to be a heavier band.
An amazing tour. Such the friendship we developed, it's, that was a special time.
Yeah, yeah. Because like you said, it was right before kind of, I mean, that time period was right before the industry kind of changed and grunge kind of came in. So it was like right on the cusp where, you know, it was kind of the perfect timing for that album to come out, like right at that year.
Well, that's what we were going for.
Yeah.
Actually. So, and it was lucky as well.
Yeah. So I won't keep you for too much longer, but at the end of every single one of my interviews, I ask the same 5 questions that I call the Metal from the Inside 5. And they're just kind of vague questions that just allow my audience to get to know my guests a little bit better. Questions that typically aren't too asked in interviews. But the first question is, if you weren't in the profession that you're currently in, which I guess we touched on a little bit earlier, so drummer or musician, what do you think that you would be doing?
Well, I always said I wanted to be a veterinarian, but I wasn't smart enough to do the math. That's why I became a drummer. I only had to count to 4. you know, I have a love for animals. I thought I wanted to do that. I think I was pretty sure I always wanted to be a drummer. I actually thought maybe I love playing timpanis in the orchestra. I thought maybe I would play timpanis in a symphony, or perhaps drums in a pit band for a Broadway play, for Broadway stages. So those were all things, but a lot of it was being a drummer. You know, I didn't expect to be famous, and do, you know, what happened. So when you're working on life's plans, you have to put it out there and go for it. And those were all options that I was willing to have as my story.
Yeah. And what was your introduction to the drums originally, when you started?
Well, I will send you a picture. I'll send you a picture you could put up. I started playing drums in my diapers on the floor with pots and pans and my mom's utensils. So that's when I started playing drums. She allowed me to play drums to the TV, to any music show like Don Kirshner's Rock Concert. I would stand up and play the snare drum or whatever in front of the TV. So it was sort of really born, it was in me right from the get-go.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because it's almost like it chose you in a way, you know? It's you know, started from before you probably could even really remember, you know? And did you, like, eventually go on to, like, play in, like, your school band or anything like that? Was that kind of how your...
Yeah, I started taking lessons in second grade in elementary school and played there, and then couldn't wait to get into, you know, the junior high, and I started playing in the jazz band, playing the drum set there, and that's when I found out girls like drummers. So I had all these girlfriends in junior high because I played the drums. I thought they liked the quarterback, but I liked the drummer too. So I wanted to be the quarterback and the drummer. I wanted a monopoly.
Yeah, 2 for 1. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't quite good enough to be a quarterback. I was a receiver. I did play football, but and I played in marching bands. I loved marching bands. I actually used to march, like, in the St. Patrick's Day Parade and the Macy's Day Parades, carrying the big triplets. And I loved the power of all those drums. And then high school, and then I played in the symphony and, you know, all that stuff. And
yeah,
we actually did a tour of the states with a few states with my high school symphony. That was a lot of fun. And then into college. You know, in college, I didn't play really organized band. I took drum lessons and played, you know, with my rock bands around.
Yeah.
And I was also the designated official party guy for the dorm.
And I'm sure like doing too, like all of those, you know, like a jazz band and you know, symphonies and all this stuff, it kind of really made you versatile as a drummer, I'm sure, you know, doing a bunch of different styles and all that stuff.
That, and it makes you hear things differently. It makes you approach playing differently. It makes you hear a song differently. You have different tools to create with. So yeah, it opens up the palette, I think, you know, like an artist palette. It opens up a musical palette a little bit more having those skills.
The second question that I have for you is, what is something that you wish everybody knew about you? And this is when I often say that, I mean, like, do you have a secret talent that somebody may not know about, or a guilty pleasure, like musician that you listen to that nobody would think, something like that?
That's a really hard question. Not because I don't want to share it. I just, I love to be a farmer. I am not really a farmer, but I love, I have a horse farm, and I love to tend to the ground and just be a farmer, and, you know, that keeps me grounded to the earth and sane, and gives me a purpose when there's no other purpose. I have the life around me to take care of, and so I love that's you know, going out on the tractor. I have a big John Deere tractor.
And when did you get that farm? Like, how long ago have you been doing that?
Well, my ex-wife wanted a horse, so we got her a horse. It was on 3 acres. We were on 3 acres in South Jersey, and it wasn't really quite big enough for a horse. But just so randomly, later on, I've always loved horses. I'm not necessarily a rider, you know, it's not a passion, but I do like horses. I like the energy they bring to your property, and they're quite amazing animals. And so I just I felt like it was in the late it was actually late 90s, early 2000s. I was like, you know what, I really need to find property with the space, and I wanted an old 1800s house and old barn. So it's just, rent, you know, you put it out there to the universe. There happened to be one for sale right by my best friend's house. So I was a godfather to his daughter, and I would go visit them, and I would drive past this farm that was for sale. It was a mess, but that was part of the beauty of it, because I got to make it mine. So I ended up buying and closing the house on September 11th, 2001, the day of the attack. So that was also a very bittersweet moment. You know, literally, we closed on the house, but then just couldn't, we couldn't finalize the bank.
Right.
It was all closed. So that's how that happened. But yeah, farming and horses.
Yeah, that's something that definitely, that's a good answer to that question. Cause I mean, I knew, cause we talked about it briefly, but you know.
No, you didn't know I was going to say that.
I didn't know you were going to say that, but I knew about it. Cause you were like, when we were trying to set this up, you had talked about the farm. So I was like, I know he has a farm, but that knows something a lot of fans, you know, Skid Row fans probably, I'm sure, had no idea about, but that's something that you do now. So that's a good answer to that question.
I don't come across as the farmer guy, but I do. I love it. I do love it.
Yeah. The third question is the stereotypical question that a lot of people do ask, but I ask it anyway. If you could, or if you were stranded, let me try this again. If you were stranded on a desert island and you only had 3 records, this is everybody's reaction. It's so great. 3 records to bring with you to listen to off the top of your head. What would they be?
You suck. It's usually 5.
Nope, we're going even lower. It's 3.
Well, I think the very, very first one that just comes to mind is Vulgar Display of Power.
Great one.
I would probably bring one from a few different genres. I would have to bring an old soul Motown record, which, how about, I could say, Probably something Otis Redding, Temptations, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And the second album would be a collection of all of those artists that I made.
A compilation, yes.
Compilation that I made, yeah. How's that? And then I love James Taylor. I love Sophie B. Hawkins. I don't know if you know who she is. So I would need a chill album, but I would say a James Taylor album. But he's got so many great albums too. But it would be a chill James Taylor. Yeah. So I could sit by the water listening to chill James Taylor, waiting for somebody to come. Rescue you.
I mean, that's a good, you got a good mixer. You got a heavy record. You got kind of a fun record. And then you got something to kind of relax to.
So I would play the Pantera to do my workouts and to just release steam. And then, then I would play, right. Then I would, Then I would play the Motown record to party to, and then I would play the James Taylor to chill and watch the waves.
And I know we kind of mentioned a little while ago the Pantera, and then you're picking Pantera again. And I'm kind of just curious, did you have any kind of relationship or friendship with Vinny? Because I know you guys, you know, toured together, and, you know, rest his soul and everything is such a immense loss. But, you know, did you guys develop a friendship during that time?
Absolutely did. Actually, with most of the guys, we were all very close. With Vinny and Dime, I had the sweetest call from Daryl. I kept it on my phone for years and years and years. I just got a message from him. It was probably mid 2000s. I don't remember the year. And he said, "Hey, dude, it's Dime. Just looking at what you're doing. It looks like you're happy, man. It's happy to see you happy. Lots of love, bro. Good luck. Miss you." You know, it was just, just reached out, and it was just so touching out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the last time I heard from him.
Yeah.
And Vinny as well, I just, we hung out a lot. I remember when Vinny was coming on the tour, we were with Guns N' Roses, and we were playing in Dallas, and I said to Matt Sorum, I said, "Dude, we both better start fucking practicing, because listen to this guy who's coming." This is a guy who's going to be opening up, and Matt says to me, he's like, "Holy fuck, dude, I'm glad that's not me," because they were touring with us. So Vinny, you know, I was very impressed with Vinny's skills and his feet and his speed, and he's just a great guy, and I probably never in my life got more drunk than I did with the Pantera guys.
Yeah, it makes sense though, right? It makes sense.
It was just a really special time in all of our lives. Yes, we all had special friendships that some lasted longer than others. And, you know, I remember those really very much fondly. And when Dime, I remember I was sound asleep and I had this incredible awakening at like 4 a.m. and I got up. And I heard a gunshot. In my head, and I woke up. My adrenaline was like a bad dream. And at 6 a.m., I got a text from our publicist saying, "Hey, Rob, I don't know if you heard, Daryl was killed last night." And I'm getting chills again because. Yeah. So we had this unwritten It's not like we were best friends, but there was a soulful connection there, and with Daryl. And with Vinny, but for some reason that happened with Dime, and it was really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if you weren't, you know, the closest friends afterwards, you know, it's somebody who played a big, you know, at that time, you know, in your life, you know, was somebody who was there and played a big role in your life. And I mean, I think it's only natural to feel that loss, you know. It doesn't really matter how long.
Absolutely. No, you're right. Have you seen the videos? Did you see our the Pantera videos and Skid Row videos of
the softball games? Which I love that, you know, hearing stories like that and even seeing videos like that of that you guys were such good friends, because I think that, you know, it's for you, and it probably you looking back on it, you know, remembering it now, you know, said it was such a great time and it was such a great tour, and you know, it's making that time so memorable. You know what I mean? You kind of look back on that, and it was something that you were living your dream and you were having fun and you had great people around, and it must have been a blast.
And we would go out and just be, you know, young goofballs, you know, that nobody could really see us in our goofiness, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. And Pantera was just one of those bands, which is funny. Pantera also had their own little glam period, which often goes a little unnoticed. I know they had their glam period, those three records before they became the Pantera that everybody knows now. So you guys had that in common too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
The fourth question I have for you is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self if you could?
Try to be present more in the moment and not look so forward ahead. You can look ahead, but be present now.
Yeah.
At the moment, because there's things that I don't remember because I wasn't present that I wish I remembered.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, oh God, it's like, what's that saying? It's like the past is something and the future is something and the present is a gift, you know, like that. I mean, that was really awful. I totally just forgot the rest of the quote, but the present is a gift. So that's the synopsis of that quote, but it's very... I wish I heard it in my head and I was like, the past is something and the future...
Let me give you one of these.
But it's true. I think, you know, sometimes I get that way too of like, I think it's natural. You're going through life, right? You're kind of, you're always... You know, when you're also like a goal-driven person too, you know, a lot of the time it's what can I achieve next, or what's the next thing on the radar or the list. And, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's important to be like, you know, it's great to accomplish things and have your eyes set on other things, but, you know, it's also important to recognize where you are right now, which I think it's only natural, human nature, right?
Yes. You know, there's that poem or saying about the journey, you know, like life isn't a, you know, don't look at life as where you're going to look at
yeah.
Where you are. So exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good one. I always say, and it's, I always ask this question too, because it's always so nice for me to hear inspirational stuff. I'm always like, yes, I always like leave the interview like feeling like inspired. But the last question I have for you is more of a fun question. If you could have one superpower, what would it be?
I know this is really silly because we can sort. I would like to fly. Now I say it's kind of silly because humans can fly, but we can't fly like a bird. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, there's. I wish I could. You know, there's jumping out of planes and a parachute, but then I have to trust the parachute. There's those. I don't even know what those calls. Those crazy fuckers that have those suits on.
Oh yeah.
They jump off of high mountains and they fly. I mean, that's pretty cool too. But again, you're depending on the suit and your skills going at 300 miles an hour through the sky. What if you get a bug in your eye?
Yeah.
I just wish that I would like I wish I could fly and soar. Like I have hawks and eagles around my farm, and you know, when they just put their wings out and catch a breeze, and it's, that would be pretty awesome. And it's kind of, you know, kind of like in a sailboat, you feel the wind, you feel the power of the wind.
Yeah.
I want to be in control of it. I want to be in control of the wind.
I don't want
my devices to be in control of the wind. So there is a little bit of control freak going on there, but I wish I could fly.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the podcast. And it was, like I said, it was so great to have you on, and you know, we're from the same area, which is even cooler. I, you know, don't know a lot of you know, fellow rock stars and people in this industry that, you know, live in no Middletown in Newburgh. So it's cool to have you on.
Well, I don't know if that's, I don't want that really on my tombstone, I think, but I don't.
Well, I feel like my area is like such, I don't know, like growing up, you know, is one of those things where I always knew. And it's funny because, you know, I think people recognize the area because of like the Chants and Poughkeepsie and all that stuff. But, you know, it's not very common that people kind of, you know that kind of, it's not quite upstate, but it's not quite New York City. And it's like this weird.
That's part of what I love about the area, frankly, is because there's so much from here. You know, first of all, it's beautiful, the beautiful mountains and countryside and farms, and only 90 minutes to my apartment on the Upper East Side, and is 2 hours to just about any beach, you know, South Jersey or the Hamptons. Go skiing up in the mountains in upstate New York or Vermont, you know, so there's everything here. And it's, but we don't want too many people to know about that, so don't air that.
Yeah, well, thank you so much again for taking the time, for coming on. You know, I know it's a little bit getting this together, but I was so happy to have you on and everything like that.
I'm glad we stayed at it. Thanks so much for having me. You're great.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You guys just finished listening to my interview with original Skid Row drummer Rob Fuso. This conversation was such a blast, and it was so much fun to be able to kind of dive into those original Skid Row records and Rob's memories of not only writing and recording them, but touring them, and what that time was like for Rob and his career. career. It was also great getting to discuss what Rob is up to now, of course, including his drum lessons, his work with Soul System Orchestras, and of course, the fun facts that he revealed at the end of this episode when we ask the Metal from the Inside 5, including his unknown love for farming and the fact that he owns horses. So that's some new information that I'm sure many of you did not know, and I also love that. I love getting into things that a lot of hard rock fans might not know about a lot of their favorite musicians behind the scenes. So I hope you guys enjoyed listening to Rob and I's chat as much as I enjoyed being a part of it. If you really loved what you heard and are interested in donating to the Metal from the Inside podcast, one way is you can go to www.anchor.fm/metalfromtheinside. Here you can click on the support button and donate either $1, $5, or $10 a month directly to the podcast. Another way is you can purchase some official Metal from the Inside merchandise. You can go to www.season-of-mist.com, type Metal from the Inside in the search bar, and our Metal from the Inside official flame logo shirt will pop up. You can purchase this shirt in any style that your heart desires. We have everything from short sleeves, long sleeves, zip-ups, pullover hoodies, women's cut shirts, muscle tanks, literally anything that you can imagine, you can get the Flame logo on. And that is another great way to not only support the podcast, but rep the podcast as well. So if you would like to purchase some Metal from the Inside merchandise, again, it is at www.season-of-mist.com. We also have that link in all of our social media, so that is where you can find it as well. Like I always say, every single dollar that I receive goes directly back into the podcast so I can continue to create even better content for you guys, get even better equipment, and make this podcast what it should be for all of you listeners. No donation is required to listen. We are available for 100% free on every streaming service from Spotify to Apple, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts. The Metal from the Inside podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts for 100% free, so no donation is required to listen. If you'd like to stay up to date with Metal from the Inside, the best place to do so is on our website at www.metalfromtheinside.com. We are also on Instagram at Metal from the Inside, on Twitter at MFTI Official, and you can also go ahead and like our official Facebook page of the same name. If you'd like to stay up to date with me, Sydney Taylor, in real time, the best places to do so are on Instagram at Sydney Anna Taylor and on Twitter at S Taylor Official. I'm always around to talk hard rock and heavy metal, so feel free to reach out to me on either of those platforms. You can also go to Metal from the Inside's site, click on the contact tab, and there you can send an email directly to me. That's all I've got for this week's episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast. Stay tuned for next week on episode 41. I'm going to have my friends Rich Catino and Jack Frost on. Jack is from Sabotage, Lizzie Borden, now playing with Aldo Nova, and we are talking all about the glam metal scene, what many refer to as quote-unquote hair metal, and how much that era of hard rock and heavy metal means to all of us, some great bands that you may not know too much about, and just a lot of fun stuff regarding that topic. So that's going to be a really great episode. Again, that's going to be next week on episode 41. That's it for me. Be safe, take care of yourselves, and we will be right back here 1 week from today for a brand new episode of the Metal from the Inside podcast. I'm your host, Sydney Taylor. See you next week, and rock on.